Good afternoon. May it please the court, Gregory Lansky, bar registration number 38515 for appellant Mario Rios. Mr. Rios was convicted after a jury trial of, among other charges, first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to life plus 80 years. Mr. Rios appeals his judgment and sentences in this case. For the purposes of this oral argument, I'm going to focus on claims 1, 2, and 4. I know that six claims were raised on in the opening brief. As for the first claim raised on Mr. Rios' opening brief, what Mr. Rios specifically requests here, the opening relief, he's asking for a remand from this court back to the district court. But prior to the remand, for the purposes of a judicial economy, he's asking this court to make a ruling as a matter of law de novo on the defectiveness of the Curtis advisement. And I think pursuant to...
So aren't we bound by People versus Blim?
But this division and People v. Gomez decided that for purpose of judicial economy, this court can make a ruling as a matter of law to deal with this advisement issue, the Curtis advisement issue.
So we're obviously not bound by the decision of another division, so I'm kind of reviewing this and de novo from that standpoint, and why wouldn't we be bound by the People versus Blim decision? Why doesn't that make sense, and why isn't it binding on us?
Well, I would say that Mr. Rios' case is analogous to the case in Gomez, where it was for the court's purpose, for judicial economy, to actually make a ruling as a matter of law on the Curtis advisement. In this case, there's a number of issues that I'm tackling as a part of the Curtis advisement. One is exactly the same issue which was in Gomez in regards to whether the prosecutor can ask him regards to whether his convictions were a result of a plea and trial, but also the wording of the advisement. It's different, and it's different from most of the other published cases. And for the fact that there was also a severed account for a possession of a weapon with a previous offender, I think this is a case essentially maybe of a first impression. And just like in Gomez, this court can, this division made a ruling that for the purpose of judicial economy, it can actually look at the advisement, see if it's defective. If it is defective, then it can remand it, to back to the district court for it to make an ultimate determination as to whether or not, it was a voluntary, knowing, intelligently done. And again, this division made a decision in Gomez, and I think in this case, Mr. Rios' case is somewhat analogous to that same situation. Otherwise, we're going to be back in the same situation where we'll go back to district court. This is raised in a post-conviction proceeding, and the court finds as a matter of law that the advisement was not defective, does not hold a hearing in regards to the evidentiary nature as to whether it's voluntary, intelligent, or knowing, and we're right back here in the same place 3 years later. I'm here, I'm asking the court for, to conserve its judicial resources, to make a ruling just as a matter of law, so this way we don't have to forego that step based on the fact that this is a unique advisement, which I don't think has previously been dealt with by the appellate courts in Colorado.
Mr. Lansky, you keep saying that this division has made a decision in Blim.
No, in Gomez.
Gomez, I'm sorry. And when this decision has not made a division in Gomez. There was another division of this court.
Division 6, Your Honor?
It is Division 6, but it's not the same. It's not the same division of judges.
Okay, so it's, although it's the same division, 6 is a different judge. I understand.
Right. This panel has not made this decision in Gomez.
Okay. Well, I would just argue that the same, analogy applies in the same purposes why the court in Gomez dealt with, the Curtis advisement. It applies here, too. And for the fact that the court in Gomez said it's not a jurisdictional issue, it's an issue what the court can't rule on. And in order to save no judicial resources here, and it is uncontroverted, this Curtis advisement, and nothing's going to change. So this court can actually look at the Curtis advisement, it's uncontroverted, and based on that, can make a decision if it was defective or not. And this way we can forego this going back up, going back down to district court and coming back up on an appeal.
Mr. Lansky, your position is that under Gomez, at least one aspect of this Curtis advisement was defective. The witness being told that he could be asked whether it was a conviction or a guilty plea, right?
That's accurate, Your Honor.
Clearly, under Gomez, that would, if we follow Gomez, that would be error in the advisement, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
However, there was no objection to the advisement, was there? At most, we're on what we would call plain error review here.
Right. Well, Judge, my response would be that a Curtis advisement, it's the right to testify. This is a fundamental right, which only can be waived by the defendant, not by counsel. The right to testify lies at the heart of due process. The right to testify gives legitimacy to the proceedings. Plain error analysis has no basis to be, it's not the analysis that is used on, you know, for a Curtis advisement.
The division that did rule in Gomez, or at least the same judge that wrote Gomez, in a recent case called People versus Moore, decided December 9th, did apply plain error analysis, and concluded that there'd be no, even if it was error under Gomez, there was no objection, and therefore we could just affirm it. In other words, we don't have to send it back. We might agree with you, but we might reach a different result.
Right, but
How is this case any different from Moore, I guess?
The case is different from Moore for a number of respects. Number one, both I and the AG are both asking for a remand. In Moore's case, the AG argued to the court that in fact they can deal with this issue and they can determine based on the record whether voluntary, knowing, and intelligent. Both me and the AG are saying no, you can't do that. You know, and in fact, the AG in this case cited Blem, you know, for the purpose that it needs to be remanded. In addition,
might change his mind when he gets up here in a few minutes now.
But again, I go back to the whole central underpinning of Curtis. The issue of Curtis is whether it's known, voluntary, intelligent. This is a fundamental constitutional right which cannot be waived by counsel.
We can't find whether it was knowing, voluntary, or intelligent, can we?
But what you can do, you can find whether or not the advisement was defective or not. And if you do a plain error analysis on this to make that ultimate determination, what you're doing is essentially you're taking it now away from the defendant, and now you put it back in the hands of the attorney. Because regardless of whether it was voluntary or not voluntarily, now it's depending on whether the attorney's actions. And that pretty much refutes everything that Curtis stands for. Plain error analysis is not applicable, you know, for the issue of whether someone's no longer voluntary right to testify.
Well, if the Curtis advisement is defective, isn't there some burden on the defense counsel to call it to the court's attention? I mean, if trial counsel here thought he shouldn't have said guilty plea or conviction can be revealed to the jury, the lawyer should have said something. I mean, otherwise, the court, he just lays behind the log, and we have appeal after appeal after appeal.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the point of plain error.
If you look at all the progeny of Curtis, and you look at Chavez, you look at Milton, you look at Gray, you look at Blem, you look at Hardin, it's pretty, either it's firmly stated in the decision no objection was made, or it can be readily inferred no objection was made. And that's for the purpose, and plain error was not applied in those cases. And that's because it's not dependent on the attorney's actions. That was the whole central underlying purpose of Curtis. It's no longer in the hands of the attorney. It's now in the hands of the defendant. The defendant has no intelligent voluntary waived that right. Otherwise, because if the advisement is defective, and like in this case in Gomez, it is defective and therefore it's not no voluntary intelligent made, now that's all going to be dependent on the attorney's actions. And that is not the purpose of Curtis. Curtis says, hey, this is a fundamental personal right which cannot be waived by counsel. And that's why Curtis sets forth that the court has set forth in the record, because what Curtis does essentially is take it now out of the counsel's hand and put it in the court's hand, so now there's a record. So the plain error analysis, then really applies. And if you look at the Moore case, you look for the authority, you know, for that case. There's a CF to a recent case, I think in September, I think it was the Wiley case. And that analogy was for a statutory aggravated sentence enhancer. And that's completely different when you're dealing with a fundamental constitutional right to testify. So the court's authority or support for its position, it's not, I don't believe, is accurate, and I don't believe it's analogous to a constitutional right which cannot be waived by counsel. And one thing the court should also be aware of is that, you know, in that Moore case, the special concurrence was by Judge Pouras. And essentially, Judge Pouras pretty much said it, that, hey, plain error analysis is not here. This needs to be remanded here. And I think, you know, the court must note that, you know, the Attorney General who did argue Gomez was, in fact, you know, at that time, was Attorney General Pouras. So now you know why she may concur, you know, with the result, and not necessarily the way.
So at least she's consistent.
I think we need to note Judge Burris's concurrence, but the problem that I have here is that we also need to note the Supreme Court's opinion in Blem, And when the Supreme Court says that defendants need not and should not raise allegations of an invalid waiver on direct appeal of a conviction, instead, such claims may be raised only in a post-conviction motion. I don't, despite Gomez and Moore, I don't know how we get around that, not following that specific direction given by the Supreme Court.
Right. And again, I think that what I would do to this court is rest on my previous argument, that it's not a jurisdictional issue, and that the Colorado Court of Appeals has already decided they can do it for judicial economy.
So we can disregard a Supreme Court ruling as long as the Supreme Court doesn't say this is jurisdictional.
Well, I think the court has to take in what the Supreme Court stated. But you also have to look at the logic behind, with the court just reviewing it now, for the defective part of it, because I think this will save judicial resources. Because most likely what's going to happen, this case is going to go back to the same judge who gave us the curative advisement. And then the judge is, most likely is going to have his view about what was proper, what was not proper. And again, then we're going to come back up here, for the purpose of the court just to rule as a matter of law on the curative advisement. And then therefore, then if the court finds, hey, it was defective pursuant to Gomez or was defective for other reasons, that's set forth in my opening brief, then we're going to go right back down, to conduct that evidentiary hearing. By doing now, we're saving and we're conserving judicial resources, by the court ruling as a matter of law where the record is uncontroverted. Now, again, I'm not asking this court to make the ultimate determination, regardless of whether it's voluntary or intelligent knowing. I'm just asking this court to make a determination as a matter of law, based on Gomez and based on, the way this curative advisement was written. So then this case can be a proper remanded and the proper proceedings in district court can occur.
So you're not opposed to remanding, but you want us to declare whether it was a proper advisement. That's
exactly.
What you're saying. Sort of half a loaf.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's the relief I'm actually seeking in this case. If the court wants me to concede, I can argue why the advisement was defective, in Mr. Rios' case. And essentially, it's pretty much on point in regards to Gomez, in regards to the plea and whether conviction. But also, it's also defective for the fact that the way the court worded that advisement objectively will lead someone to believe that, these prior convictions can be used for purposes other than impeachment. Essentially, in the curse advisement, the court stated that they can cross-examine you, they could ask you stuff which could hurt your case, if they ask you stuff which to help their case, they can bring in evidence, solely for the fact that it was not previously presented. And then it said, or they can try to impeach you as whether or not you're a credible witness. The way that was worded, essentially, allows an objective listener to say, hey, these convictions can come in, not just for credibility purposes, for other purposes.
And what words of the judge suggest that? It could hurt your case? What words of the advisement suggest, except for the punctuation of the reporter's transcription? What did the judge say?
For the fact that it says that, it could come in for the fact that it has not come in. And these convictions had not come in previously.
These convictions.
But then he can infer that they could come in for other purposes other than credibility. There's not a situation like we're in Gray where the only issue was, he left out the word only, and there's not a situation where I believe it was in Blum where he left out the jury is going to be instructed as such as to credibility. In this case, it has both of those issues, both in Blum and Gray. Both those issues were left out. And in addition with the fact that the court said they could use it to hurt your case, and the fact that it can come in for the fact that it has not come in previously, can lead them to believe, hey, these convictions can come in solely for the fact that it had not been come in, and they can be used for some sort of purposes. And if you look at the prior conviction, it's for an aggravated robbery, which can really have a pretty bad effect, in relation to the charges, how they were, they were charged and alleged, by the prosecutor. And with that, we reserve my remaining time. But Judge, do you have a question?
No. Sorry we took up so much of your time. I know you want to reach the other issues, and I if you want to give them another minute or two, it's my fault for asking all those questions.
Okay.
May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman, and I represent the people in this matter. I would urge the court to not consider the Curtis advisement issue based on Blim. I think it is correct that Blim is clear in its language that it says that these claims should be raised in a post-conviction proceeding. And, you know, I'm always sort of fascinated by seemingly procedural bars or limitations because they ultimately turn on some sort of substantive reasoning. And I think the court in Blim explains why they're applying this, which is that ultimately the question is really not necessarily about the advisement itself, but ultimately whether the defendant's waiver of his right to testify was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And I think the court gives some excellent examples in Blim of where those situations arise, where the defendant may have had a Curtis advisement in a trial the previous day, or may have talked to counsel off the record about this. And there's, I would say, some implication in this case that there was some discussion. The judge says, I'm sure you've talked to your attorney about this, and no one says anything. So it's very slight, but there is some indication that there was some discussion with counsel. But I think ultimately what the Supreme Court is getting at in Blim is that we have to go ultimately beyond the advisement itself and find out what the defendant really understood. And I think as Judge Boris points out in her concurrence, and she cites to a case called Brewer, this is in the Moore opinion, also whether it had any effect on the decision not to testify may be significant also, because I think that case points out that there may be several factors in a decision not to testify or to testify, and they may have nothing to do with what the defendant claims is the error there. So ultimately, those are the underpinnings, I think, of Blim. Blim isn't simply a way to bar a direct appeal claim, but it recognizes that it's more efficient to raise the claims in a post-conviction proceeding because we get to the heart of the matter ultimately there. I think the Gomez opinion, while I would argue was incorrect in reaching the decision, that assuming that it's correct, that it's really a very narrow exception to Blim. It's not a swinging door that is open the door to allowing the Curtis advisement aspect to be raised in direct appeals piecemeal and then go back for a hearing. I think what Judge Webb was recognized there was that that the law appeared to be unsettled about whether you could ask these questions about, was your conviction the result of a guilty plea, or in the alternative, was your conviction the result of a trial conviction, and that it was more efficient to settle that question in Gomez before sending it back. And ultimately, he does go on and reach the advisement, and arguably, maybe he didn't have to do that. But I think he's recognizing a very narrow exception rather than the door is open. Again, I would disagree with that exception, but I don't think it's the broad door that opens these questions in all these cases. And obviously, that's one of the issues that's been raised here. As Moore says, it would not be plain error. But again, I would just urge the court to just not address the issue at all. I wanted to comment briefly on also the concept of judicial economy. And from time to time, I've been asked that, isn't it more efficient for us to just resolve this question here rather than send it back? And I think the answer is no for several reasons. One is, again, that the ultimate question is going to have to be resolved by the trial court. The other is the process that we're really contemplating here would be this court rules piecemeal on the advisement. Then it goes back for a hearing in the trial court, and the trial court makes a ruling, and then it comes up on appeal. So we have actually three proceedings where Blim contemplates that it's done in, I guess, at the most two. Everything is resolved in the post-conviction proceedings below, and then it comes up on appeal. So I think in the long run, judicial economy is better served by following Blim.
Mr. Lansky is suggesting that if we remand it, the court can find that the advisement was adequate and stop there and not make a finding whether there was a knowing and intelligent waiver because the advisement was adequate. Then it comes back to us, and then we have to decide whether the advisement was adequate if we don't decide on this. And if we said it's not adequate, it goes back, and then there's got to be hearing on whether it was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. And I think his suggestion that's going to make a lot more work. And I'm not sure if there's some reason why we can't remand it with instructions to find both whether it was knowing and intelligent, as well as whether the advisement was defective. Maybe it's compressing too many things into one case, and it's hard for the judge to contemplate that, but...
Well, I would hope that the judge would rule in the alternative, that the judge would say when whether they determined that the advisement was right and whether he or she then also, whether the defendant fully understood. So I think to anticipate not reaching the second part of the question, is a problem. And yes, ultimately, let's assume that would happen, that the trial court would say this advisement was absolutely fine, denied, and it comes up on appeal. And yes, then we go back and forth, but I think, again, you may have a similar result here. And I think one of the problems in this particular case with that approach is the defendant's argument. One of his claims is that the defendant wasn't properly advised about whether his prior conviction could be used only for impeachment purposes. My reading of the language is that it's very clear that he was advised of that and that advisement is adequate. But assuming that his argument has some persuasive value, that may turn ultimately on how that was phrased, the nuances there, the breaks in the court reporter's paragraphing where the semicolons go. But I think the language is clear as to that the judge is connecting the use of prior convictions to the credibility determination. He's arguing that it's different. So I don't think that's a perfect example of where this court is not well situated to assess whether that advisement, assuming that our arguments are...
How's the trial judge in a better position? I mean, he knows what he meant. He's not going to ask the defendant, what did you understand I meant? Is that the purpose of the hearing?
I'm sorry, it's the nuance of how he said it. I think the defendant's reading is arguably that it was like a stream of statements where I see a pause in the judge's comment where he says, in the language, he says, or they might attempt to convince the jury that your testimony is not worth believing. That is that you're not a credible witness. And in that respect, if you have any prior felony convictions, they can bring that out through their cross-examination. I think defendant's reading is that it should start, that that last statement is connected to several statements before. And I think the way the judge may have said it, and the judge was there and the parties were there, may arguably make a difference as to how that would be interpreted. When I tell people about appellate practice, I always say it's like the movie My Cousin Vinny, where the guy says to the police, I shot the clerk, and then the officer testifies, he told me he shot the clerk. And I think that's my point, is the nuance of this arguably can make a difference. So that's why, again, I don't think an appellate court is in the best position. I think the trial court is in a better position to address that kind of a dispute.
Which is a good memory. Said exactly how he phrased it. But, I mean, he's stuck with the transcript, too. You think he's going to remember how he said it that day?
Well, I think he and the, assuming it's the same attorneys, the defendant, of course, can testify as to what his understanding was and why. Ultimately, we may move beyond this, but my point is simply, it's not always, ultimately, it's always the best place to start is the trial court where this actually occurred and everyone was present and has a recollection of what happened. If there aren't any further questions, I would thank the court for its time.
Thank you, Mr. Holman. And Mr. Lansky, going to ask the bailiff if you would give Mr. Lansky an additional 2 minutes so that he can address some of the other issues that we prevented him from addressing with our questioning.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that.
Will Mr. Holman have to?
I guess we do have to look at that. We'll give Mr. Holman had 5 minutes or so left. I know this is unusual for the appellee to have rebuttal, but since you're bringing up new issues, possibly we'll allow Mr. Holman to respond to those within that time frame that you had left.
Very well.
Okay.
I just want to respond to one comment that Mr. Holman just stated in regards to if the remain in the court can take a look at everything. But prior to court to doing that, in order for the court to grant an evidentiary hearing, the court has to make a ruling as a matter of law on the advisement. So that has to be done first before the court can make those additional determinations. And that's why I'm asking for purpose of judicial comment, the court should take a look at Sakura's advisement and make a ruling as a matter of law de novo, and make a determination of what needs to be remanded. As for the second argument, Mr. Rios moves to suppress the identification of the victim, Victor Martinez. In doing so, he cited to the case of People v. Monroe. The state proceeded only calling the detective, Detective Vanderveen. Detective Vanderveen's testimony essentially, besides stating that he was the victim, Victor Martinez, was interrogated for over 12 hours before he made any alleged identification. But in regards to everything else that Victor Martinez said, it was only done through the detective. The state never called, Victor Martinez at the independent source hearing. And at the independent source hearing, it's a very high burden. It's a clear and convincing burden for the people to prove. In this case, the district court ruled as that the identification, the one-on-one identification, was impermissibly suggestive, and then therefore the court essentially subsequently made a determination as the independent source. But the state only called the detective. There was no way for the court to determine the reliability, the foundation and the credibility of these statements.
These detective testified as to the circumstances, these horrible circumstances, of what happened on that night, didn't he? Based on what Martinez related to him.
Yeah, but that's only what he was related to him. We don't know exactly whether that was accurate or not. It was never independently verified. And I think that the real basis for the court to rule there was independent source was the fact of the prior relationship. But that prior relationship was all essentially hearsay information.
Is hearsay barred in that situation?
I believe it is barred in that situation because it's a clear convincing standard. I mean, if you look at a preliminary hearing, or you look at probation violations, I mean, I think the case law is pretty clear that you can't, completely and exclusively rely on hearsay. And those proceedings are lower burdens. Now, in this proceeding, is a higher burden, and all the state did was just do, this hearsay information.
What's the best authority you have that hearsay is barred at one of these circumstances hearings, identification hearings?
Because if you look at the rules of evidence, and what says where hearsay is admissible, it does not say that these hearings are it's admissible. There's no such that rules of evidence apply to these proceedings.
There's no case law that addresses the situation exactly, or something like
that. But there's a rule of evidence.
I understand. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Lansky.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Holman, would you like to respond to that particular issue?
Just briefly.
Yes.
I'm unaware of any case law that has held that at an evidentiary hearing on an identification issue that the court cannot rely on hearsay evidence. I just wanted to point out one thing, which is the defendant, of course, has raised a confrontation clause claim, and I think those are sort of interrelated, which I don't think is valid. But I just want to point out that, of course, at trial, the defendant had a full opportunity to question Mr. Martinez and test his identification of the defendant in this case. So on some level, the claims that he argues that are problematic to him are, I think, satisfied in that situation. I think the hearing here was fine and the trial court's ruling was correct, but I just wanted to add that comment. If there are no questions, I would thank the court for the additional time.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for your arguments. The matter will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.